because you know, in order for evolution to occur, there needs to be like some sufficiently old Earth, right? And I don't think there's any reason to think that the Earth is the age that would be required for evolution to occur, because I'm mainly going to contest radiocarbon dating, unless you have other ways of knowing how old the Earth is. Or not, sorry, not radio, sorry, radiometric dating. But I think is it potassium argon dating that's used for the age of the Earth?
I believe you can use potassium argon, but rubidium, strontium, and uranium lead is the most common one.
Yeah. What do you know, like the reliable age range for uranium lead dating?
What the range of error is, I off the top
Let
of
me
my
just look
head, I
for
don't
sure.
know.
Okay, hold on. Let me just look this up. Okay. Yeah. Well. So mainly, I'm going to argue that there are environmental effects that will be relevant in determining these things. I know a lot of people would say that you know the nuclear decay is you know it is the rate at which it decays is intrinsic to the atom, right? It can't be affected by you know outside sources, and so you know that's going to be like reliable no matter like how hot it was or the pressure or you know the things like that. I'd
Yeah, that's
argue like
very well attested and experimentally and observationally
I mean
confirmed.
I have I think many examples where that's not the case. Like for example, I'll just give you like a very easy one, right? Something that you know I'm not saying this happens, but something that would affect like the result of a of some radiometric dating would be like if nuclear fission or fusion has occurred, right? Because this changes the types of atoms, the numbers of the total number of nucleons is preserved, but the atoms that go in, the atoms that come out are different. So like that would affect
Nuclear
radiocarbon.
decay is fission.
The fission we're talking about here is like a you know, there's some atom that like absorbs like some neutron and then that moves it to an unstable state where it then collapses into two other atoms of like we're talking about the kinds of decay that is relevant here would be like beta and alpha decay, right?
There's three types of beta, alpha, and gamma decay.
Yeah, well, there's a few more than that, those are the sort of like the main relevant ones. But obviously, if you know if there's like a particle accelerator or whatever that was like slamming you know protons into a nucleus, then I'm sure that like if you were to date the sample before and after that happened, you'd get like wildly inaccurate results. So there are certain environmental effects that can change the result of you know of radiometric dating, right?
We can imagine them, but there's been no like if I like if I take like when you build a bomb, this is just absolutely to what you're saying. This is 100% true that the uranium core for these bombs is absolutely radioactive and decays. But then what happens is a fission event, either through the gun type bomb or the implode. I don't remember what those are called, but there's an implosion type bomb. Then that radioactive sample now is just obliterated because yeah, it undergoes a different kind of fission. So that absolutely happens, but the idea that that kind of thing happens in nature, therefore our samples are unreliable. We can imagine that, but that actually is testable. So like there are data tables of like meteorites, for example, that literally contain thousands upon thousands of meteorites. And but there's a mean age and a standard deviation, and the mean age is 4.6 billion years old, and the standard deviation is microscopic. So the only acceptable, and what's really crazy about those meteorite ones is it's actually the example that would work best for what you're saying because they're bombarded by cosmic rays for billions of years, and those cosmic rays carry vastly more energy than anything we can do here on Earth with particle accelerators or with nuclear bombs. So if there was the ability to fuck up the dates or whatever for them, it would be in the meteorites, but they're among the most consistent.
I think that the fact that we have I mean it's not evidence for it, but it would certainly be like let's say that the types of cosmic rays are the kinds of things that would be able to affect this. So we're just saying that there's some type of decay that's relevant here that would be affected by being bombarded by these rays. You'd think that by constantly being hit by these rays and having you know think like a bits of the atom like knocked off and whatnot, you would rapidly accelerate the decay of these meteorites, as well as the fact that
We wouldn't
that
accept
they're all.
you can't speed up the decay. What you can do is cause a bunch of it to undergo fission, and so you just like delete a bunch of your sample.
Well, no, but if this were to happen, like for example, with the with say like electron capture, right? Like electron capture increases the atomic number by one, which then makes it more unstable and would cause a like a decay to happen faster, right? Like
It decreases the atomic number by one.
electron capture.
Yes, because the proton absorbs the electron, becoming a neutron.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, sorry. No, it. Yeah, that's yeah. And then there's yeah, sorry, it's by the way. I was thinking of the what's the other bound state beta decay that increases it by one. And that is
Yeah,
affected
a
by
neutron can release an electron, becoming a proton that advances it one.
yeah, but bound state beta decay is affected by the ionization state of the atoms. Like that would be another thing that's affected by environment, right? And so we have both like ways to increase and decrease the atomic number that would be infected by environment. So like let's just say in theory, I'm not saying this did happen, but like if there was like some state where there's like a bunch of electrons everywhere, it's all really high pressure, so the electron density around the nucleus is gonna be really tight. We can imagine that electron capture events are gonna happen like way quicker, and so the any event that causes like we can imagine the atomic numbers of these atoms would decrease much quicker than they would in like some normal state. And so like for something like that, we can say that that would like definitely muddle results, right? Because all these things would have their atomic numbers decrease much faster than we'd expect. And so we go and check the ratio of daughter to paired isotopes, and there's going to be like a lot more of the daughter isotopes, right? So for things like that, that would be a very easy example of just something that could reasonably occur if there was like maybe and we have high energy events that release tons of electrons or other maybe positive ions like all the time in space, right? There's gamma ray bursts and CMEs, and so it seems entirely like non like there's a quite high chance that these asteroids, given that they're all going to be in in roughly the same environment, that any event that like affects one of them, it was is probably reasonably going to like affect the other, right? And so if there is something that would accelerate the decay such that we get these really skewed results, we'd think it'd be skewed the same way for all of them, right? Unless like one of them was just hiding from all the bombardment of radiation. So I don't know how we can say that we have certain.
Okay, so what you're saying, you're countering my claim, which is if there was something that was screwing up the dates, then cosmic rays and gamma ray bursts and whatever, because all the high energy particles that could create fission that screws up the dates, it would occur in space. So the meteorites would bear out that evidence, and what we would expect from that is the evidence would be, or the meteorites would be, would range wildly in date. What you're saying is, well, no, because they're all in the same environment of space. They are all experiencing the same effects, so they would all be changed in the same way. Two things for that, which one would be, I don't think that's true because we know of the existence of, well, you know what? I don't know how old they are, though. So this might not be a good example, but we know of asteroids that have come to Earth that came from a different planet. So they th their time in space would be not the same as the others. But I don't know the date of those Mars meteorites. I actually suspect they're not 4.5 billion years old. That probably isn't a great argument.
Well,
But
also
the other
if
thing is, we actually have this current technique called isochron dating. Now I need to speak to a geologist on this. I need PhD Tony to back me up on this. But isochron dating means you take a sample from different, you take different size samples from a particular spot that you're trying to analyze, and then you analyze the ratio of parent material to daughter product in them. Because there is the argument that you don't know how much parent material you started with or whatever, but the isochron dating technique gives you these slopes. And because all of your different samples, if all of your different samples actually are the same age, then the isochron lines intersect at a certain point. And so we find that, and so you can overcome that that burden that you set up with, well, we don't know this one particular thing. The asteroids in space, I highly suspect, are modeling that same isochron technique, because they're sampled, they're different sizes, and they're sampled from different regions in space, because the asteroids we find in space are the remnants of planetesimals that were obliterated in the formation of the solar system. So they're literally sampled from different places and different objects. So I have a very high suspicion that the isochron technique actually applies to these, and it would undercut this hypothetical. No, you don't need 8 glasses of water a day. Yes, dogs do sweat. No, coal doesn't turn into diamonds. I've compiled hundreds of bits of information like that in Facts That Aren't True. Get your signed copy by going to the link in the description. But these are also just total hypotheticals that you're bringing up.
Well, no, all I'm saying is that there's, we have this this dating method, and it's giving us this, one number, but there could be any number of environmental effects that would be plausible in space that could have affected this. And so I'm saying, like, we shouldn't be, like, have any certainty in this number, because there's nothing to say that, like, there wasn't some period of high energy bombardment, which would have, give us entirely skewed numbers on these things. And so for something like that, it's, unless we can rule out these events occurred, I have a list here of types of nuclear decay that are affected by the environment. If any of these things, could have occurred, then we would get skewed results. And so you'd have to rule out, like, the feasibility of each and every one of these kinds of nuclear decay, and even say that, like, well, the theoretical ones are also going to be, like, implausible, in order to say with strong confidence that this age is correct, that this is how old these things are, right? Like, I'm not saying that the dating methods, with isochron dating can't get you, like, reliable results on how many of the original parent isotopes were there. I'm just saying that the speed at which these things can happen is often changed by the environment.
I mean, you can say that, but we have no actual evidence of anything that can speed up the decay rate. If we had that, then we would be doing it here on Earth, and you'd be richer than Elon Musk, because it would mean we've solved the radioactive waste problem.
Well, I mean, we do have it. We have reactors that recycle old radioactive waste, and because it's in an environment where it's being bombarded by, like, other particles, by the time the waste is goes through and is now waste of the recycler reactor, it is far less radioactive than if you were to take it in, like, a box and, like, just leave it outside for how long it's been in the recycler reactor. So we do have reactors.
It's less radioactive, but it's still radioactive.
Obviously.
The amount of money that has to be spent to get that radioactive, that spent nuclear fuel into a place where it's environmentally safe and all that, the cost of that is enormous. If we could instead, if we knew how to speed up radioactive decay, then we could just do that with those samples, and then, like, the cost benefit analysis for that would just be enormous. And what that would also necessarily do is it would so if you speed up the rate of a reaction, it releases more heat than it otherwise would. This is why a candle doesn't explode. It releases its heat for a long period of time. But gunpowder does explode because it releases all of its heat immediately. So we could actually prolong the life of our nuclear fuel probably that way too, which means we would get more out of it. So the cost benefit for this would be extraordinary. And in this world we live in, there is no, you're not going to sell me on, if we knew how to do this, we wouldn't already be doing it.
Well, no, I think we are already doing this. For example, if you take like a uranium fuel rod,
we're not speeding up the fission rate. We can't do that. If we could do that, we would be doing it.
We are because we're inducing fission, right? Like we cause the fission to happen by taking the two uranium rods and put them next to each other, right? There's a reason that, like, when you take two rods of uranium.
Fission and nuclear decay is a kind of fission, but radioactive decay and fission that is done in the in those whatever, it is not the same thing. What you need to get rid of the radioactive samples. It has to naturally you can either have it fucking blow up like well, fissile material can't explode. It can't go thermonuclear. That is a myth. But it's still radioactive. So you need to get it to basically to become stable as fa at a faster rate. And we can't do that.
Well, I don't know what you mean, like fissile material can't go thermonuclear. I mean, that's exactly what like
It
plutonium
can't.
239 does in a nuclear bomb. It's pressurizing enough that such that the
We don't
fissile material.
use that's not what we use in our nuclear facilities. You have to enrich uranium. It takes an incredible amount of work and energy to get
Oh, no,
enriched
yeah.
uranium for nuclear bombs that is only specific isotopes are capable of going thermonuclear. The isotopes that are in nuclear power plants aren't those isotopes. They can't do it.
I mean, technically, anything could go thermonuclear with like enough pressure. It's just like the kind
No.
of pressures that you need for these things are, like, well, anything that's radioactive, with enough pressure, there will be a the reaction will happen fast enough that you get, a nuclear explosion. It's just the kinds of things for like for something like like uranium 238, for example, is just so incredibly high that it's unfeasible to like ever being able to have like
Yeah,
this.
like it can't happen in a factory. You can't create the conditions for the implosion type bombs
No,
in those
but
factories. It can't
for
go thermonuclear. Not in the factory.
but like the fissile material that's in nuclear bombs obviously can't go th like thermonuclear. So like some fissile material like can go. But it's also the case that like it doesn't really matter if the type of decay that's induced in or the so the type of fission that's induced in with the nuclear reactors that like speeds up the process by which uranium turns into lead is not like the same type of decay as the kind of like naturally occurs intrinsically that can't be changed, but it still is, a process that is affected by environment that changes, some atom to some other atom, which all that like all of that's all that's needed for to mess with dating, because if you had like some environment thing that like let's say turns uranium rather than into lead, it turns into like thorium or something, right? And so this happens to a bunch of uranium. Well, now you go to date this thing, and you have all the right lead there, right? All your daughter product is still there, but all of your uranium is gone and turned into thorium. And so now you try and date it, and there's no uranium, and so you get like an
I
inaccurate
told
result.
I know what you're saying, but you wouldn't get consistent dates if that was the case, because no sample, it is in identical conditions, so it can't produce the exact same effect every single time. We know, I can't remember where it is, but there is a known naturally occurring nuclear reaction. And so that uranium is it's undergoing fission and nuclear decay at the same time. And so it's not decaying at a rate that you see like in a different kind of sample. I would be curious if anybody's tried to date it and see, but like we know what that would do, and we have no evidence of that.
Well, if like let's say these things were all in space for roughly the same amount of time, like however many thousands of years or hundreds of thousands or even millions of years they're up there, it's all roughly the same amount. Maybe one landed on Earth a thousands of years before the other, but just for the relevant facts, same amount of time in space. The only way they're going to have their decay rates sort of change in a way that would meaningfully affect dating would be from things from the sun and things from like very very far deep space, like gamma ray bursts and things like that, right?
Okay, I gotta interrupt you. I don't know why I didn't think of this before. I think your argument collapses for a much simpler reason that I didn't think of before. Those conditions only apply when they're in space, right? When they get to Earth's atmosphere, it shields them from those particles because those particles decay immediately into like muons and other things because of the thickness of the atmosphere. Want to learn how to make people do this?
I'm angry because you're a little f***ing weasel, and I want to f***ing slap you. That's why I'm angry. I'm going to get a little bit triggered when you f***ing treat me like I'm an idiot when I know way more than you do.
This book will be your guide. I debunk all of the common anti-scientific arguments, plus some uncommon ones. Every single copy is personally signed and shipped by me. There's even an audiobook. Link in the description. Right?
Well, certain particles decay into mutants and stuff. It's you get like tau neutrinos that like decay into like neutrons. The neutrinos like the.
But basically, a meteorite sitting on Earth is no longer bombarded by cosmic rays.
No, but then you have like other effects. So like a meteorite sitting on Earth would have different effects. But it would still have like for example, now you have an environment that's going to be there's a lot more like stuff floating around. So you'd a lot more there's obviously gonna be like high pressure, and so electron capture would probably happen slightly more often if it's like on Earth than in space. But again, we're saying that assuming that these things were in space for roughly the same amount of time, then they're going to have these effects.
Well, but that's not true because the meteorites have landed. So what I was saying there is, the conditions in space are what are hypothesized as the accelerant. It's not even an accelerant of the nuclear decay. It's that it causes fission, which just artificially reduces the amount of parent material, which would make something look older than it is. That's perfectly fine. But those meteorites arrive to Earth at different time intervals, meaning new meteorites should appear the oldest because they've been in space the longest, and very old meteorites should appear the youngest, but that's not the case. There is no connection between that. They all date to the same age. But
well,
also this doesn't just apply to meteorites. This applies to Earth. If you accelerate, like the thing I was talking about earlier, radioactive decay releases energy. So if we're either speeding up the radioactive decay or causing all this fission, then the Earth would heat up to thousands of degrees.
Well, that would only be for the the stuff in space. Obviously, the stuff in space would be heating up like very quickly. I'm not saying that
the Earth's mantle contains unthinkable quantities of radioactive material.
Oh no, yeah. I think that the only real feasible time that I can imagine this stuff happening would be in space. So this is pre-Earth formation. All the stuff is going to be in the same environment and it is going to sort of undergo these sort of effects. And then once it reaches Earth, it's I don't think that that all of these things are like going to be decaying on Earth at this insane rate, and vaporizing the Earth's crust. That's obviously absurd. And also, if you look in space, there's clearly not like all of these high energy particles that are like you don't take a sample of uranium and send it up to space and it comes back and it's all lead now. It's been it seems to me like there could plausibly be some single high energy event, whether it's a coronal mass ejection or some crazy event that sends all of these high energy particles. A bunch of fission occurs and all of this stuff that's been floating around in space is then becomes much older looking. So something like that, like it would just be a single, and so this would explain why new meteorites that fall aren't older looking than old meteorites, because they only got this big aging in like a single event all at once for like all of them for the most part. I'm sure that there'd be some that were defective.
I mean okay, I don't think you can expect to see the reliability of the dates based on that, but we're just we're only going to go in circles from this point.
Yeah. I think we've talked about all the, I mean, there's a few more things on dating, but we'll start with the I guess the other half of evolution, which is the fact that even if you have this time, I'd say that it's still implausible that these kinds of changes can occur within animals.
I disagree, but actually we're going to stick on time for just a little bit longer, because would you agree that if somebody proposes, a hypothesis, mm-hmm. and they get consistent data for that hypothesis, that's really good. Now you can, and what you've done, is offered an alternative explanation that says, well, the data may look the way it does for another reason. And that's fair enough, but if different sets of data that have nothing to do with the original thing, but agree with it, are produced, then you can't just, that counts as additional data, and it's incredibly strong because there's zero expectation for the outside data that's a completely different discipline and field, and even completely different physics or whatever, to agree with it. Are you with me so far?
Yeah.
Okay. So if the Earth actually is billions of years old, then the universe has to be billions of years old. And essentially, the universe necessarily has to be older than the Earth. The universe just clearly is billions of years old. So we call this consilience. It's been confirmed by an outside piece of data. It's the equivalent of, look, I found the murder weapon with your fingerprints on it at the scene. Somebody could say, well, that could have been planted there by somebody else. Okay, but I have a video of you doing it too. So now we can't hand wave away the other thing as a coincidence, and we've actually severely undermined the alternative hypothesis. So the fact that we can see billions of light years and the universe is just clearly billions of years old only reinforces our original idea.
Well, the universe, I think, because I think it's obviously the case that the universe is expanding, right? If you imagine that there's like a sheet of paper and there's like some dot, we'll say, is like our observing point, and then there's a bunch of planets around us and they're all emitting, you know, they're all reflecting light, and so we can like based on certain things we can, you know, see like how far away these things are. And so if the universe were to expand, let's say planet one emits light, and that light is going to take 100 light years to reach the planet. But then in the meantime, space expands such that now, by the time that the 100 light years has passed, the planet that emitted it is much, much, much further away. And so we, given this, we can say that, like, the universe actually hasn't been this old. It's just that it has stretched so much that the distances between the things that are emitting light and now that we're receiving it is something like in the billions of a...
That's already part of the Big Bang model.
Well, you can definitely have
the diameter of the observable universe is greater in number than the number of in terms of light years than the age of the universe.
Yeah. But I think that if we take the diameter and like let's say there is like much, much more rapid expansion than what is currently proposed under cosmic inflation, that would explain the large distances we're able to see without having to have like an.
That doesn't work. That would contradict everything about cosmology, because if you rapidly expand the universe, then nothing in the universe, no large structures could have formed in the universe, because your expansion is so many orders of magnitude stronger than gravity, then you can't, there cannot possibly have been an opportunity for anything to have formed.
Yeah, that makes sense, and I'm sort of just spitballing. But I don't think that just because the universe is billions of years, like we're saying, yeah, if the Earth is billions of years old, then the universe is billions of years old. But it doesn't follow that then if the universe is billions of years old, that points to the Earth also being billions of years old, right?
But those two points of data necessarily have to coincide, and they do. The idea that and your alternative explanations for the apparent appearance of an old universe and the apparent appearance for rocks and meteorites that look old have literally nothing to do with each other. They are separately created post hoc excuses.
The thing with explaining the universe is just sort of like a spitballing, but let's just say that, yeah, we have very strong evidence that the universe is like billions of years old. Right. Let's then say that, the Earth, as far as our radiometric dating, appears to be billions of years old as well. And so we have, you know, two data points. One theory is that the Earth is actually billions of years old because these decay rates are constant and sort of like unchanging, but depending on environment, or at least environmental effects are very, very minimum. And then the other theory is that there was this big event that that caused all of these things to decay in such a way that's like much quicker. I don't see how the universe being billions of years old would make us prefer one of those over the other, just because if the Earth is billions of years old, then the universe has to be billions of years old. It seems like the inference has to go the other way to have evidence there.
I don't know what you mean by that.
Sorry, yeah.
The Earth can't be older than the universe. So,
Yeah,
like, necessarily, we could falsify our idea about dating the Earth by finding out contradictory data about the universe. Instead, it's exactly what you would expect. Whereas, insert God, sure, you. The meteorite thing is a completely naturalistic alternative explanation for why the meteorites look as old as they do. But under the expectation that God created the universe recently, the only reasonable, acceptable answer is a universe that's young. Instead, there isn't. So, but what then is done is a completely, I wouldn't even say
No,
pseudoscientific, anti-scientific, post hoc rationalization of, well, God just made the universe look old. Then why aren't
I
we
believe
saying
in
God just made the meteorites look old? Why did you appeal to nature? Because we know that a naturalistic explanation is the explanation that is convincing. But we're not doing it for the other thing. I mean, we tried to with the accelerated expansion, but that falls apart for such really obvious reasons that now we just have to go to old-looking creation or whatever.
Well, I'm arguing here for what is called a gap creationism. So I think that there was a very big gap, potentially billions of years between, the let there be light and the days of creation, right? So it would have been totally fine for there to be billions of year old universe with like stuff floating around, and then God then would take all the stuff, later and create an Earth that I think is far more recent, or at least I think that there's no reason to think. I have an outside reason being the Bible to think that the universe is or so that the Earth is this old, but I don't think that there's any naturalistic reason to think that the universe is or so that the Earth is billions of years old because there's this other data point that or so there's other theory that explains the meteor data point that we have no reason to prefer over the other one. Why would we
No. We
prefer?
have a reason to prefer because of the total lack of evidence for the alternative idea. But we got to go on to the evolution thing.
Okay, yeah. So I'm going to sort of mainly just criticize the idea that from DNA evidence. So like we can get to fossils and stuff, but I think the main issue is DNA evidence. So like things like endogenous retroviruses, things like this. I think that they are have no reason to point to any like sort of common origination, or at least haven't seen any as of yet.
You think that endogenous retroviruses aren't evidence of shared ancestry between us and apes, other apes?
I don't think they are at all, no. I don't think that any DNA evidence is.
If two things are related, then there necessarily would have to be genetic, which is to say hereditary, evidence of it.
Not necessarily, but I'd say in most cases, yeah.
No, necessarily, because the only way that organisms are produced is through reproduction, and there is a hereditary molecule.
Well, yeah,
You
I'll say like
can't,
in most
you
cases.
can make the most desperate argument ever, which is convergent evolution of genetic markers. Sure, you can argue coincidentally. The same virus inserted the same fragment of DNA into a non-related species and us. Sure. But this is calculable. We share over 200 retroviral insertion sites with chimpanzees. The odds of sharing even 12 of them are greater than 1 over the number of atoms in the universe. For only 12. We share over 200.
Well, I mean, I'd love to see some some sources, like I guess corroborating this number, because it seems like, well, first of all, we need to figure out like the exact type of retroviruses that are inserting here, right? And because different retroviruses have different like preferred insertion spots, right? Like for example, I think HIV
Yes.
prefers to insert itself into like protein coding regions, right? Whereas like other viruses like to insert themselves at like either like a stop or like a start of a coding sequence. So for things like that, like we have definite hotspots for where these things like would insert, right? And so like if
So the genome has well over 10 million locations where a retrovirus can insert itself. So for a source for that, you would go to it's actually from a website called Stated Clearly, and that's John Perry's website. He's an educator, but it's DNA Evidence for Evolution: Endogenous Retroviruses from Stated Clearly. Now he's going to link the study data for that claim. So it exists. Scientists have like Scientists don't, they didn't make up that number.
yeah, no, well, I know that, like, I think that there's definitely spaces in the tens of millions for where some like retrovirus could insert itself. But what we're talking about is the where it would prefer to insert itself, right? Like, I think that that they would have like, I mean, I've not to like anthropomorphize viruses, but you know, they have certain spots where they're more likely to insert themselves. And I think that for the types of viruses we're looking at, with like where they are going to insert themselves, most likely, it seems not entirely implausible that for if there's like some bit in the genome where there's viruses really like to insert themselves, that we would see something like 200 of them lining up. Now, I wouldn't be able to like give you the exact numbers on that,
Why
but it seems like.
would we share over 200, which is like more than 95 per, like of the
There's like
retroviral
11 that we don't
insertions
share.
we have, the chimps have like 95% of the same ones. There is zero, you cannot hand wave away the coincidence of the thing that phenotypically is the most similar to us also has the almost all the exact same insertion sites that we do, and genetically, even that has nothing to do with genetics. It's just a different DNA analysis. Retrovirus insertions actually have virtually nothing to do with genetics. It's just a hallmark in the DNA, and they're 98.6% genetically identical to us. Those three coincidences, to look at that and say that doesn't prove ancestry, it proves nothing other than that.
Well, like let's say that like some virus A, right, inserts itself into some place in like the chimp genome, and then the same like species of virus inserts itself into some other place in the human genome. With enough of these viruses, right, like it's not like well this one virus it inserts itself into point A and then point B in the chimp genome. It could have been the case that like the order in which they inserted was entirely random. So it's like it's not like the virus inserted itself in the same place in both the chimp and human genome. It's that one virus inserted itself in two different places, and then another virus inserted itself in two different places, and then it fills out all the pairs of places in the human genome.
You're just saying viruses have, or our DNA has affinity sites for insertion. So, of course, we have the same location spots for it because over time the virus just did this to the humans and to the chimpanzees. This is completely unreasonable for a young Earth creationist, non-evolutionist, non-common ancestry view. Because according to the non-evolution view or whatever, there is absolutely zero expectation that all of the humans would have the same ones, because it's been such a there has not been very much time. There's absolutely zero expectation that us and the chimpanzees would have accumulated the same ones, because they live in a specific part of the world where there are virtually no humans, but The biblical view is that the chimps and the humans were in completely different places. So the viruses you would expect them to encounter are absolutely not the same at all. There is no time for global distribution. And there's absolutely no expectation or time for every human to have got... You wouldn't even expect all the humans to have the same ones. These are effectively what we call haplotypes. For blood types and eye color, those are like examples of... Those might not exactly be haplotypes, but haplotypes are clusters of genes that are inherited together. So like Native Americans, for whatever reason, overwhelmingly had, I think it's type B blood, which is just a weird quirk of their geographical isolation and genetic drift. But that's an example of a haplotype marker you can find, and we know of all kinds of others. So this, you'd have to believe, the only way this can work is if Adam and Eve had all of the retrovirus insertions, and the chimpanzees had them. That's the only possible way all humans can have them. But then it's not even a virus thing anymore. It's just our genome created that way all of a sudden. If you're going to argue that Adam and Eve were created without the retrovirus insertions, but then they got them, if Adam and Eve can get 200 and whatever retroviral insertions before they start having children, then humans have to have unthinkably large numbers of thousands of them. Because if we can accumulate 200 in that amount of time, then in the thousands of years since then, we need to have more, and we don't.
Yeah, well, I think it would be absurd to say that, like, humans and chimps were created with these viruses, I mean, for, like, a number of reasons. I think that like, we could just say that there may have been many lineages of humans that had these different viruses, but that there was only, like, one that ended up surviving, and this is the ones we have today with all of our retroviruses. That would be, like, the only thing I could say to explain that. And as far as chimps and humans are in completely different parts of the world, they're going to be encountering different viruses, I don't think that's true at all. I think that that chimps and humans are very genetically similar, and so the same types of viruses are going to be infecting chimps and humans, right? It's very rare.
But you don't find the same viruses all throughout the world, except for like uniquely human viruses like rhinovirus and HIV or whatever. But I mean, even for those, like HIV, there are HIV hotspots in the world where it's more common. Where it originated, actually. There's no argument that's going to make any rational or empirical sense that the 200 something viruses that happen to be able to infect humans and chimpanzees and insert retroviral sequences are somehow globally distributed. There's no rational argument for that.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Well, it was good talking to you. I have to get off now. I have D&D.
All right. Have fun with that.
Yeah, see ya.
Bro lives in a fantasy world in his spare time when he's not living in a fantasy world. That's actually pretty crazy. Get a free book, 2 free audiobooks, and ad-free videos by becoming a Patreon member.